This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Every Day I'm Hustling, written by Vivica A. Fox with Kevin Carr O'Leary, performed by Vivica A. Fox.
This book is dedicated to the memory of my late father, Mr. William E. Fox. Preface. I don't know what brought you to this book, darling, but I am so glad you're here. Maybe you got knocked down and you need a little help getting back up. Perhaps you invested in loving the wrong person. Maybe you don't even know where to start on your dream and you see everyone else in this Instagram-filtered world living theirs. I've been there. Let me tell you a secret. When I was a little girl growing up in Indianapolis, no one could say Vivica. I used to get called Vavisha or Vavika. Anything but the right way. And honestly, most folks just couldn't be bothered. I was so sensitive about my name that I made it easy for everyone else, going by a shortening of my middle name, Anjanetta. You can call me Angie, I'd say, like an apology. In life, sometimes we run away from the things that make us unique. I didn't become Vivica until I came to California and met my first casting director at an audition. I told her my real name, then quickly blurted out my usual. But it's okay, you can call me Angie. Why? You have a beautiful name, she said. As a matter of fact, you should be Vivica A. Fox, so people will always remember you as Vivica's a Fox. And honey, I thought I was gold. By 1992, I'd been on an episode of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and landed a spot on an NBC sitcom by the same creator. The show was called Out All Night, and I got to play the daughter of none other than Miss Patti LaBelle. Patti! Out All Night was set in a club, so I was meeting musical guests like Luther Vandross, Mary J. Blige, TLC, and Mark Wahlberg when he was just Marky Mark. I made the cover of Jet, and I knew those people back home in Indianapolis could say my name now. I had made it. Then one morning, we all came in for a table read. We taped a show the night before, and I thought we killed it. Yeah, you killed it, someone said. The show's canceled. Clean out your shit. They weren't even going to air the last show. Now, I wish I had a tape of myself crying at that table, because, Lord, it would show how deep and ugly I can go as an actress. I was in such a state that Miss Patti couldn't believe it. Child, you crying so much, you about to turn white, she joked. You're gonna be all right. You'll see. Here I had one of the most talented and experienced entertainers in history telling me I would be okay, but I couldn't hear it. I was devastated. I was living in this cute little condo in Inglewood, thinking I'd made it. I'd put 2,000 miles between little Angie and the person I wanted to be, and now I was losing it all. It got worse. I would go on audition after audition, watching my bank account dwindle as each time I would make it to the final callback, and then they'd go with a bigger name black actress. At the time, Jasmine Guy from A Different World was the it girl blowing up. Me? I was just blown up. Finally, I had to call home to tell my mom I was in trouble. Evelina Fox spent my childhood working. She was a single mom who held down two jobs to provide for us four kids after my parents divorced when I was four. My mom believed in two things, work and God. I'll never forget the call. I gingerly told her that I might need a bit of a loan. Mom, if you can help me out, she says, yes. And I cried. And I told her, okay, I'm not going to be calling and asking for money again, so, you know, I got to figure this shit out. Write a letter, Mom told me. Put it in your Bible and pray about it. He will bring it back to you. So I got on my knees and I wrote this. Lord, I want to be successful. I want to be a star. I want to work as an actress, and I've got a taste of things, but it seems I can't get over the hump. It seems I'm always almost just making it and then coming up a little bit short. Lord, if you could just help me to stay focused and help me to stay positive, I promise that I'll be good and do good and give back. Maybe you're feeling the same way. You just can't get over that hump. And you keep coming up a little bit short. For me, the answer came when I asked. And the answer was to get to work and keep at it. I worked my ass off, sometimes literally, to get Independence Day, Set It Off, and Kill Bill. I took risks to get Curb Your Enthusiasm and was offered the role on Empire because the creator, Lee Daniels, liked how I handled myself with the silliness of Celebrity Apprentice. I got to return to the big screen as Jasmine in Independence Day Resurgence and be the head chick in charge on my own show, Vivica's Black Magic. My grind don't stop, and people notice. Sure, there have been failures and heartbreak in relationships. I'm working on that. Trust and believe that. You can always trust that as a single black actress in my 50s, I understand struggle. I get up every day to fight for my place in Hollywood. And sometimes I'm still my own worst critic, looking at what's wrong instead of what's right. Just this week, I saw a paparazzi photo of me walking out of something with my arm waving. See, you had your arm up and look at that tummy, I said to myself. You look a little fat through there. And then I had to say, snap out of it, bitch. You got to be your biggest cheerleader. Get out of your own way. I want to help you as you get out of your own way, too. Now, my language can be what I call street but sweet. My friends didn't nickname me Ghetto Barbie for nothing. But I can always take you to church. The Lord loves a scrappy girl. I owe this book to my mother, who told me to write down my dream. But this book is not about making a wish. I want to provide concrete, real strategies for realizing or even figuring out your dream. And I hope it's a big one. There's nothing wrong with having big dreams. It just means you have to put in some effort. Some people today think that they can swipe right or press send and something can happen overnight and you don't have to work for nothing. It's so different from what I know to be the truth. I've had to work for every damn thing. My mama told me growing up, you go work. I don't care if you think you're cute. Yes, you are, but your ass is gonna work. So take my hand, darling, and let's work together. Part 1, The Start of Our Hustle. Lesson 1, if you want to hang with the big boys, you're gonna get knocked down. I wanted to look like a goddess. This spring, the beauty magazine Sheen threw me a party naming me Woman of the Year, so I felt I had to look the part. They had flown me from L.A. and put me up in a lovely suite in the Atlanta Marriott Marquis. I still had a few minutes before I needed to head downstairs to the black tie gala, so I did one last check in the full-length mirror. My hair was up high and off my face, and my makeup artist, Darion Haylock, had given me a smoky eye, glowy skin, and a bold lip. For a big event, we always put just a little glitter on my face, a little shimmer, to feel regal. Instead of a LBD, I went with a little black Alexander McQueen gown that my girl at Neiman Marcus Beverly Hills, Banny, helped me pick out. A halter neck, down to the ground, stretched knit. The dress hugged every curve and accented all of my assets. The dress showed off my arms, which you know I had been putting in some extra work into defining since I picked the gown. And it had a tasteful cutout to show the cleavage. The girls were sitting up proper, I thought. Running my fingers over the dress's jeweled neckline, this wide collar of sparkling jewels was what sold me on the dress. It reminded me of Audrey Hepburn's diamond necklace in Breakfast at Tiffany's. Woman of the Year, I whispered to myself, turning to get the whole look. Usually at this age, Hollywood tells women they're going to put you out to pasture. Actually, they don't tell you. They just make you invisible. If you don't get the hint and go quietly, they will knock you down. Time and again, I have done myself the favor of getting back up. There was a knock at my hotel room door. It was my big brother Marvin and his wife Thelma and their 8-year-old son Miles Ryan. They live near Atlanta, and one of the reasons I was so excited about the gala was that I could share the night with them. "Looking good, sister-in-law," Thelma said, as I hugged Marvin. "Right back at you, sister-in-law," I said. Miles Ryan was so cute in his gray suit vest and blue striped tie. "You ready to do this?" I asked. My little nephew broke into his megawatt smile. "Yes, Sparkle TT," he said. He always called me that, starting when he was a little baby who couldn't take his eyes off my diamond earrings. I'd kiss his cute face, and he would reach for them and say, "Sparkle." When we got downstairs, photographers waited at the entrance to the party. I was posing up, really giving a "she has arrived" performance. And then I started laughing. I noticed Marvin and his family were standing off to the side, not sure what to do. "Come here," I said, waving them in to stand beside me. "This is about you, too. I wouldn't be here without you, Brother Marv." Flashbulbs went off on the four of us, and I drew Miles Ryan closer to me. There was not an ounce of nerves to this beautiful child, and his megawatt smile shone even brighter in the camera's flash. He loved the attention. "Look at you," I told him. "You're a star." Miles looked up at me and got this little glint in his eye that reminded me so much of pictures of me as a kid. "That's right," I said, assuring him the same way I would tell myself when I was a kid. "We are stars." Let me tell you a story from back in the day. I was 6 years old, 2 years out from my parents' divorce. My dad was visiting my mom's home in Indianapolis, and we four kids were all with him in the backyard. My mama had a cute little greenhouse, wood-framed, and about 1,000 square feet of us kids crowding each other. We were 2 blocks from the projects, nestled in a long row of ranch houses with just washed cars parked on concrete driveways. Evelina Fox had worked 2 jobs to buy her own home and live a life of independence. My mother had grown up in West Point, Mississippi, farm girl, used to working from sunup to sundown. Her childhood was all about milking cows, shoeing pigs, and picking cotton. School was her salvation. She walked the miles back and forth from school like it was her higher calling and graduated from West Point High School. I once asked what parts of farm living she enjoyed. She laughed. "Nothing," she said. On her own with 4 kids at 32, my mom brought that same dedication to providing for us and to proving that she would never, ever have to rely on anyone for a single thing again, especially my father. William Fox was that city boy who got him a good old country girl and brought her up to Indy. They met when she was 21 while she was visiting her older brother in Elkhart, Indiana. She had an extreme beauty and poise, my father, who was 80 at the time, told me. She was like Sophia Loren, and I wooed her with my city swag. And he broke her heart. I'm a daddy's girl to this day, don't get me wrong, but I know he broke her heart. So whenever Dad visited, my mother made herself scarce, which wasn't hard for her to do when she was working so damn much. Breakups are never easy, as I've learned. It was summer, and my big brothers Marvin and Sandy were playing basketball at the hoop my dad had set up for them. Marvin, our family's quiet go-getter, was 10. Sandy, the most athletic and mellow of our family, was 7. Our big sister Shuggy, already our mama bear at 11, was left to play mother while our mom worked. That day she was fussing over me, telling me not to run around quite so much or I might get hurt. Marvin's nickname for me was Cartwheel Angie, because I was always spinning, running, having fun. My mother used to say, "Now that one there of mine, ooh, she's busy. She's always busy." My mother has a southern voice that flows slow like honey, and I can hear her telling me, exasperated, "Sit your little hyper self down." Dad was shouting pointers at Marvin and Sandy as I watched them fly around the backyard with the ball. Any time spent with my dad revolved around sports. And back then, my brothers always got the lion's share of his time and attention. He'd take them to wrestling matches and Indiana Pacers games at the state fairgrounds. And the boys would come home thrilled, so pepped up from what they seen. I wanted in. So I jumped for the ball yelling, "I want to play! I want to play!" Now, I was a little bitty thing, no bigger than a minute. But man, did I take that ball. I was perfection on that court for 3, maybe 4 seconds. And then Sandy, quiet, sweet Sandy, knocked me right over with one jab. I was so embarrassed and mad. I ran over to my father, reaching my arms out to be held, a flood of tears about to roll down my cheeks. "Uh-uh," Daddy said, "ain't no crying. Can't be doing that." Hold up. I was the baby of the family. Didn't everyone have to be sweet to me? Then he told me something that's carried me through these 5 decades. "Angie, if you want to hang with the big boys, you're going to get knocked down. It's on you to get up. You're going to get knocked down, and it's on you to get up. It's a lesson that you might not see in most self-help or business books, so let me be the one to tell you. Success does not guarantee the absence of getting your ass kicked." The next time I went in to play ball with my brothers, damn straight they knocked me down, but I got up. Playing with the big boys made me a better player. And I kept playing with them until I could beat them fair and square. Dad started taking me to the Pacers games, and he played basketball with me when he visited. He worked with me on my jump shot until I could nail it and do the Fox family proud. I always got to tag along with my brothers to the Coliseum to see wrestling matches. This was the WWA, an Indianapolis-based early version of WWF. No frills, but plenty of drama. Our favorite was Dick the Bruiser, a ball-headed monster who took on some cocky up-and-comer every week. He demolished the new guy as we cheered. I was trying to fit in so much with my brothers that they taught me all the wrestling moves, from the backbreaker to the headlock. I got put in so many chokeholds. Now, if I was cute with them, I would get punished. I think that's what made me so tough. As I was growing into a jock like my brothers, it made me very different from my big sister, Shuggy. My sister will tell it to you like it is, but she's always had such a sweetness to her that no one called her by her real name, Alicia. It was Shuggy. Drawn out like that feeling of eating a piece of pie after a religious fast or a juice cleanse, whatever you believe in. Mom made it clear that Shug was in charge, and I think that was hard on her as a kid. I know she was proud that my mother felt she could trust her. But Shug had to alternate between being a little mama telling us what to do and a regular teenager who was discovering boys. The Foxes had a reputation for being good-looking, and I thought she was the most beautiful girl in the world. As I followed her lead in all things, she taught me how to be cool. She was popular, and because she was stuck watching me, she would let me tag along with her friends. One Friday night, I went along with her to USA East, the big roller skating rink in Indianapolis. "We're going to teach you how to skate," she told me. USA East was a wonderland on Friday nights, the lights down low, with spotlights of color dotting the floor. I was there with all these big kids, roller dancing with their hands in the air, to great music like Stevie Wonder's "Signed, Sealed, Delivered." I wanted so bad to be as good as her out there. But I wiped out again and again. "I keep falling," I said to her the upkeep time I landed on my ass. "Falling is a part of it, Angie," she said. "You'll get it." Now I hear the echo of what my dad told me about getting back up. Shug was just as much of an influence on me. We shared a bedroom, and the boys had their room. I let Shug have the big closet, and I took the little one. I always gave way for Shug, especially when she got a job. She started working at Target and needed to dress on point. But I always stole her clothes. She hated that. I was in such a rush to grow up that I didn't care if I drowned in them. I was a good sneak. But one time, I let my friend Sheila B. borrow one of her cowl neck sweaters, back when cowl necks were really in. "She ain't gonna know," Sheila told me. Then her fool ass got makeup on the collar. Shuggy knew all right and beat my butt good. Shuggy cooked for us all the things that my mama taught her. And she always stretched out the meal with tons of rice. She always made hot water cornbread exactly to my mama's Mississippi standards. Now, I'm not what I call a cooker, but I saw Shuggie and Mama make it enough times to tell you how. Shug's hot water cornbread. Now, all families are different. This is how Shug does it. Some people like it a little bit sweeter, and they put in sugar. Shuggie's is sweet enough. 1.5 cups of Aunt Jemima's self-rising white cornmeal. Okay, there are some areas that are deprived of self-rising cornmeal in grocery stores. Amazon will hook you up. Order it prime and rush it over. 1 egg, about 2/3 cup of boiling, scalding, super hot water. Grease or lard. You can also use some leftover bacon fat. Get the grease or lard nice and hot in the pan. Use enough. Meanwhile, mix the cornmeal in a bowl with egg. Slowly add hot water, stirring with the back of a fork until it's cakey like Play-Doh. If it's too loose and mushy, you've put in too much water. Just add more cornmeal. Too dry? Add more water. Spoon or pour desired amount pancake style in the hot grease or lard. Flip them over when you see the edges begin to brown. When both sides are golden brown, you're done. The cornbread is so nice on a plate of black-eyed peas, which Shug always cooks up on New Year's Day. It's a traditional food that welcomes a prosperous new year. Here's how she does it. Shug's Crock-Pot Black-Eyed Peas. First things first. Soak the beans overnight. It's worth it. Nobody suddenly says, I'm going to make black-eyed peas this instant. No, you plan for it. It's an event. 16-ounce bag of dried black-eyed peas, soaked overnight. 1 pound of meat. Salt pork, smoked ham shank, smoked turkey wing, turkey leg, etc. 1 small onion, diced. Water. Lawry's seasoning salt to taste. Before you soak the beans, do a quick sort through to make sure there's no stones or rotten beans. Soak the beans overnight, leaving a few inches of water covering them. Once the beans have soaked, drain and rinse them. Place the meat in the crock pot, then add in the beans and diced onion. Pour in enough water to cover everything. Liberally salt with Lawry's. Set the crock pot to low for about 4 hours. Taste and add more Lawry's if needed. Discard the bones and break up the meat. Serve and welcome abundance. As you welcome abundance with gratitude, know that I am so grateful for the blessing that is my sister. I adore Shug. She loves with all of her heart. Every single time I play a mother, whether I'm in the kitchen in soul food or running through the desert in Independence Day, you can see some Shug up on that screen. I even had a big roller skating scene in Soul Food during a flashback. And yes, that was me falling on cue. More than that, in Soul Food, I use the way that she talks to her beautiful daughter, Sharday, to capture that mix of love, concern, and bemusement when I had to sweetly keep my on-screen son in line. In fact, after she saw it, she'll call me. She said, Angie, you were playing me in that movie, weren't you? Yes, I was, Shuggie. I wasn't sure how she would take it. You inspired me because you've always been the glue that holds the family together. She said, well, you did a good job, she said. You skated real nice, too. That meant the world to me. Growing up, my sister Shuggie definitely became my surrogate mom. She provided structure and accountability in a house that could have gone wild if she had shrunk from the responsibility of caring for us. When we speak as adults, I can give her all the gratitude I have. But back then, I took her for granted. At a young age, she was not asked to be our shadow parent. It was assumed she would step in. Shug had to not only demonstrate maturity to us, her 3 siblings, but also be an example of leadership in the absence of our parents. Through her day-to-day actions, she taught me that you can say family comes first all you want, but you have to work to back it up. She's still doing it to this day, keeping all of us kids tied together, no matter where we go in the world. And now she and her daughter have the close relationship I wish that my mother and me could have. A little while ago, a camera crew went with me back to Indiana, wanting to see where I grew up. I took them to see my mom, who still lives in my childhood home. And this rude woman from the crew straight up said, "Why do you have your mother still living in such a little house?" She doesn't know Evelina Fox. Here's the answer every time I ask my mom if she'd like to move. When I separated from your father, my brother helped me to get the down payment. I bought this house, Angie. I worked hard to pay it off, and this is my house, and I like it here. That person from the crew just saw a 3-bedroom house with 1 bathroom and a little driveway in the middle of what she considered nowhere. She was looking down on the woman that I have looked up to my whole life. I say this to you, and I mean it. Don't let anybody dim the shine of your accomplishments. If they're not paying your bills, why in the hell would they validate your worth? I watched my mom work so hard to have the money to raise 4 kids by herself without ever again depending on a man. She was always juggling 2 jobs, a nursing gig here, a school thing there. When she was home, my mother didn't have time to be anything but a disciplinarian, making sure that we were clean, getting good grades, and always going to church. We lived across the street from our church, Breeding Tabernacle. My mom's feeling was, if those doors are open, y'all gonna have y'all asses in there. Show enough, as she would say, and with no lip. Go on over there. If we ever said we were bored, her response was, are you being lazy? Because I don't have no lazy children. My happiest memories of my mother are in the kitchen on the Saturdays she could be home. She would be in there cooking all day while she put us to work cleaning the house. She had everyone up and at 'em with pine saw and bleach, scrubbing everything. To this day, I have to have that pine saw smell in my house. That's how I know it's clean. But now, I have a housekeeper, okay? Even with 4 kids, my mother stretched the generosity of her heart to take in another from time to time. My dear cousin Dana from South Bend used to spend the summers with us. We were born 2 days apart, and she was like the baby sister I never got to have. One summer, my mother's generous heart was stretched with another kid in the house. Mom has the ceramic set that she uses as decoration, hanging in the kitchen for all to see, a giant fork and spoon arranged with the Lord's Prayer on a plaque in the center. It's like Jesus's coat of arms, I guess. We weren't supposed to even touch it. Y'all running around in this house, Mom yelled at us. If y'all break my ceramic set, Lord, there will be nothing left of you. We were running, and Mom was at work. Dana did this whirl and bumped right into the spoon. It fell. Miracle of miracles, Dana caught it. But we were all screaming so much that the poor girl got scared. In slow motion, we saw her lose her hold of the spoon, and it fell to the floor with a crash. The Lord's Prayer popped out, and with it our lives, we were sure. The spoon was broken. Ooh, y'all gonna get a whooping, my brother Marvin yelled. Dana burst into tears, hyperventilating and making a sound like, vit, 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 vit. We were all certain we were dead. Mom came home that night and was sure enough furious. She didn't whoop anyone. It was like her heart was so broken she couldn't bear to do it. Mom had and still has a gift for making sure you know if she's disappointed in you. Dana didn't get her whooping, but she got a new name. To this day, we still call her Vit Vit. When I was about 10, Mom got a really good job working at Eli Lilly, the big pharmaceutical company in Indianapolis. She was proud of working there as a tech, getting to the plant early, staying later. She still wasn't able to give us as much time as she would have wanted to, but she was a provider. That's how she showed her affection, making sure we were secure. And she wanted us kids, especially me and Shuggy, to know that no one would ever give us anything. I am thankful to this day that she instilled her work ethic in me. My friends make fun of me. Why do you work so damn much, Vivica? You can pay the light bill. Yes, I can. And I always want to have that financial freedom, just like my mother did. But that work ethic does come with a price. And maybe you're paying it in your own life. It's really hard for me to let people do things for me sometimes. Does that sound familiar? Whether it's the weight of emotional baggage or a carry-on suitcase, I'm always saying, I got it. I'm strong. I can do it. It's only recently, as I've grown more comfortable in my skin as a single woman, that I've been able to simply say a gracious yes, thank you, to an offer of help. We Fox kids threw ourselves into every extracurricular activity there was. At Arlington High School, I wanted to be the best at track, volleyball, and cheerleading. And of course, basketball. I was always very open to finding surrogate parents in my teachers, like Mrs. Fletcher, the teacher mom of my friend April. She spoke in such a dignified, kind manner. Her husband was also a teacher, and from 6 years old to senior year of high school, I spent a lot of afternoons in their home after school. It was the biggest, nicest house I'd ever seen black people have. They were always in teaching mode and taught me to really notice my surroundings. When we went for a walk with them, you didn't just go by a tree. "What do you notice about that tree, Angie?" Mrs. Fletcher once asked me. "It has yellow flowers." "That's right," she said. "It's a tulip poplar, the state tree of Indiana." I'd walk by that tree countless times. Now, it was special. My daddy moved around a lot, but we spoke on the phone weekly, and he came to all my games. He had a way of getting my attention and quietly coaching me, especially during basketball. I played power forward, where you have to be tough and play offense, but also make a quick turn to defense and shut down an opposing player. I had so much energy and took every game so seriously that he could tell before anyone else when I was getting too hyped. "Hey, chill out," he'd say. "Chill out." The phrase he used was to attack intelligently. If I got too hyped out, the other team could capitalize on that. So whenever he saw me spaz out, his chill was code for play your defense, listen to your coach, attack intelligently. I will never forget the time he showed up once with a pair of high-top gold Converse sneakers for me. I was so proud of them shoes. He started buying me more shoes for sports to encourage me. He got me so many sneakers that I once packed 2 left shoes in my gym bag for an away game at another school. It was a big basketball game, one that could get us into the Indianapolis Girls City Championship. So I panicked when I opened my bag before the game and saw what I'd done. But I put them on and tried to make a joke out of it with my team. What could I do but do my best? And it was one of the best games I had. Maybe because I had to prove to the other team that I wasn't a damn fool with 2 left feet. My coach, Miss Maxine, said after, "Foxy, you need to wear them 2 left shoes more often." We went on to win the city championship. Indianapolis did us right, making a huge deal of our school's victory with an award ceremony. My father came, but not my mother. And all I remember is that I was a bucket of tears. I was so proud of the team. I also wish my mother had come. Years later, I took Dad to a Pacers game, and we got to sit right on the floor. He looked up behind him and put his arm around me. Wow, from way up there in Section 9 to down here sitting on the floor. I also took him to the Super Bowl in 2012. The first time it was held in Indianapolis, I was thrilled. But unfortunately, my dad ended up flirting with the lady beside us. I was like, "Dad, could you please focus on the damn game?" He was always a ladies' man. Always. I definitely got my horn dog nature from him. Because we were of like minds, I could always talk about boys and even matters of sex with my daddy. I remember when I was in my 20s and dating all 6'11" of Eldon Campbell from the L.A. Lakers. I turned to my dad for advice on some concerns I had about fidelity. It was my first kind of public relationship, and I didn't want to look stupid with everyone watching. I would ask him, "Dad, what does it mean when he does this?" Or tell him, "He disappeared on me for a little while." And my daddy would say, "And did you two get into it?" "Okay, then he might be doing a little something-something, but you stay strong. If he really likes you, he'll come on back. And if he don't, you're a good-looking girl. You're my child." My dad's approach to trouble in a relationship was simple, and this is a direct quote. "The best way to get over that is with another pair of thighs. Keep it moving. If he don't like you, he don't get you. Keep it moving." My mother's approach to disappointment in relationships was to do a love lockdown on her heart. My dad's go-to was to find the next person. They each decided the goal for me in love. Don't get hurt. My parents simply had different ways of showing me how to go about it. For better or worse, for richer or poorer. LOL. In relationships, we can unconsciously repeat the patterns that we saw growing up. Our little corner of Indianapolis was all I really knew of life. But my brother Marvin was about to spark the beginnings of my plan to see the world. We ended up calling him Sarge because he enlisted in the military as soon as he turned 18. It was during peacetime, thank God, 1978. We have the same July birthday, 4 years apart. So I had just turned 14. Since we share a birthday, I sometimes joke that we're twins. He has my energy, but goes about it in a quieter way. The army came to get him so early in the morning. I watched from the front window, seeing my mom hugging and kissing him goodbye. And she was crying, barely able to speak. It was sad, and yet we were so proud of him in that uniform that we were happy too. "I'll be back," he kept saying, "and I promise I will stay in touch and I'll write." Marvin and I always wrote to each other wherever he was in the world. It was so exciting for me to get his letters, filled with stories about being in Germany and Turkey. He went everywhere. He was still in the army a few years later when I was trying to make it in California. Some new girlfriends wanted to show me a good time, so they took me to Soul Train. I did the line, dancing my heart out in a gray dress. I thought it would look cute on TV. I got a letter from Marvin a little bit after the episode aired. "Was you on Soul Train?" were the first words. Huge! He said he was watching TV with some of his boys, and he started screaming, "That's my sister! That's my baby sister! Oh, my God! It's Angie!" That was the first time I was ever on TV, and I thank God I was able to share that moment with my brother Marvin. But for now, I was in California while Marvin saw the world. I started to see a little bit of it, at least. When my mom did get time off, we would take road trips down to see her family in Mississippi. Ooh, it was country as hell. Huge acres of good old corn and greens and tomatoes. Her family always had lots of land. They had horses and cows, and they ride on tractors and all that craziness. And I never felt more cityfied than when I was standing in Aunt Catherine's cow pasture with my cousins Baba Sue and Daryl. "This is cute, Mom," I'd say. "When are we leaving?" It was trips to see my family in Chicago that I loved, particularly to visit my Aunt Corrine, or, as I and everyone else called her, Madam King. She owned a salon on the South Side, Madam King's Hair Fashions. She was fabulous and one of the first African Americans in Chicago to own her own salon. She loved makeup and had that hair, honey with the blonde highlights in it. And she turned out to be my fairy godmother. It was in Madam King's storefront salon, a palace to a kid, that I first started reading movie magazines. There were tales of beautiful people doing extraordinary things with their lives. Ebony magazine ads featured gorgeous black women looking right at the camera, right at me. I was reading one of Madam King's magazines the summer I was 13, just before I started high school. Her big eyes suddenly shone on me. "Angie, do you want to be in a fashion show?" I didn't give her half a second in case she changed her mind. "Yes, ma'am." "Then come here, baby. We're going to cut your hair." I put myself in Madam King's hands and was never the same. She cut my hair short, a little pixie with a little bit of a shag, you know, leaving it a little bit longer in the back. Ooh-wee! I was fine with that little hairdo. And I walked in that fashion show, moving my arms exactly the way Madam King had told me. I can't for the life of me remember what I wore, but I remember smiling at the audience and all those faces smiling back. I got bit by the entertainment bug, compliments of Madam King. I decided then and there I was going to be a model. What was there not to like? You go on stage and everyone is looking at you. And you got to wear great clothes and be in magazines. You were fabulous. Why not be fabulous for a living? I started high school with that haircut, and I made the cheerleading team. They were like, "Ooh, Angie Fox, that haircut is banging. Got it in Chicago. I would always say demurely, with a pat to my hair. It was then that I started telling people, I'm going to be a star. Their response was not encouraging. Angie Fox, you ain't going nowhere. But I kept telling people, I'm going to be a star, you'll see. I just needed to figure out how. Now here's what I want to warn you about setting a goal. The bigger the dream, the more likely people will tell you not to try. There are three types of people who will try to hold you back. There's the basic motherfuckers who don't want to see you succeed. That's one group. They're the easiest to ignore. And actually, you can use their power to inspire you to show them how wrong they were. We'll talk about them later in Lesson 8. They can take a seat until we call for them. Okay? The second group doesn't want to see you get hurt. And so they want you to lower your expectations for what life can hold. These are the toughest to handle because they think that they are doing the right thing. They truly do care about you and are afraid to see you stick your neck out and get hurt. You have to be grateful for their concern, but you can't allow them to limit you. And the last group, the worst, is scared to see you succeed. I call them the kind of company that loves misery. When I recently created Vivica's Black Magic, the Lifetime show, chronicling the journey of creating a Las Vegas residency for male exotic dancers, I was working with this fine-ass young man. His baby mama had no interest in him except his child support until he started getting a little bit of attention and fame. He was a fan favorite even before the show came out. And people who follow me on Instagram saw that I was throwing him a little support, and so they did the same. He started getting a ton of followers, and his ex saw him start to pull away from the pack and make it. Instead of giving him support, she was suddenly saying, "No, come back here with me." She wanted him to give up the work that was obviously getting results. If he failed, she succeeded. She was relentless in this newfound interest in him. And I told him that for his sake, he just needed to stop responding. "But she calls me from numbers I don't know," he said, desperate. "Then don't answer your phone, period." "Child," I said, "focus." These people don't want to see you pursue your dream. These are also the types who want to keep you single. They don't want you to have a healthy relationship because then who could they feel superior to? Or maybe they are in the cubicle next to you at work, bitching about their job, but not doing anything about it. Do you think they want to see you send out a resume or ask for an informational interview at a dream job? Nope. They want you sitting right next to them so they have someone to bitch to. It's the classic crab in a bucket mentality. If I can't have it, neither can you. Put a mess of live crabs in a pot, and on their own, each could escape. But instead, they pull each other down again and again. If you're finding yourself surrounded by those crabs, check yourself. Your squad needs an upgrade. Lesson 2. Get your squad together. You'll need them. Now, I'm sorry if you have a lot of school pride, but Arlington High was the best school of all time. I would put my school up against anybody's. The teachers demanded excellence, and we students expected each other to live up to Arlington Golden Knights standards. It was an almost all-black high school at the height of the disco funk era, and the students would show up to school dressed to kill. People were like, "Ooh, the fine girls are over at Arlington." And they were right. Everybody used to look good. Especially Reese, who was a good friend of mine. I love me some Reese because the girls were all jealous of her. Reese was so good looking. She couldn't walk 2 feet without some fool girl trying to fight her. But she took shit from nobody. I remember one day I heard this big commotion right after school. I turned a corner and saw Reese fighting 3 girls, and she was hanging. The girls all left like it was their choice and they didn't get their asses handed to them. Reese was adjusting her clothes. "Damn, girl, you fine," I said. "Why are you fighting like that for?" She didn't answer me. I didn't understand that the thing that made her stand out also made her a target for insecure people. But she refused to shrink from it or become invisible. God had made her beautiful, and she wasn't going to let haters dim her light. Reese was an important part of my indie squad. A squad is that all-important group of friends who support you and motivate you to shine. I also had my girls Sheila and Bev, my roller skating buddies. I had mastered roller skating at USA East, and we would get our outfits together so that we could show off. Baby, we did not mess around. We would get song lyrics pressed on our T-shirts in the old-style funky letters. My favorite said, "Have a funky good time." It was like our cute little uniform. And we would make sure our jeans were pressed with the same ultimate creases in them. We all lived around each other, so I'd drive them over to the rink in my family's brown Cutlass Supreme. And that car had to be clean, because whether we were going to USA East or the State Fair, it had to be on like the Oscars red carpet. You had to arrive. Your white walls had to be spotless. The rims, shiny. The black tires, still gleaming from the armor all you just put on. Our squad would turn it out for Arlington's basketball games. We were a big deal for our part of Indianapolis. Our rival high schools were Broad Ripple and North Central. Those matches got the biggest turnout and felt special. With all of our hopes aimed at that one shot, that one winning basket. Game days, we'd be all dressed up in our Arlington Golden Knights gold. With me in my little gold cheer uniform, I never missed a game, since I was a cheerleader for the boys, and then I'd be bringing it home on the girls' team. The games were a nice place for my girlfriends and me to meet boys, of course. I was in my element, totally confident. And junior year, everyone was talking about the hot boys from Tech. There were these twin basketball players, Irwin and Derwin, who all the girls talked about. Ooh, baby, them twins right there. We cheerleaders would whisper to each other. Gosh, I had a crush on Irwin. Tech wasn't a rival, so it was fine for everyone to hang out after the game. Irwin came up to me, all tall and gorgeous. And we just started hanging out. He was a totally nice, sweet guy. We could drive around and talk about everything. I was my mama's good fox girl, so our dates were always PG. But I swear to God, I can't say the name Irwin Shields without letting out a sigh of happiness. My dates were PG because Suge and I had a lot of friends who were getting pregnant. Just hot kids sneaking off and doing what comes naturally, but nobody telling them about safe sex or exactly how you can get pregnant. I watched classmates start having kids at 13 and 14 years old. The majority of my girlfriends got pregnant. In fact, I watched their struggle and knew it was not for me. I was on a basketball court when one of my girlfriends told me she was pregnant. This was my junior year. My first instinct was to tell her I was sorry. "I'm not sorry," she said. "I'm going to raise my baby with Kenny." Kenny was the boyfriend who only treated her like she existed every other day. The rest of the week, he was on to some other girl. "Okay," I said, with no judgment in my voice. "I don't look down on a sister unless I'm helping her up. Does he know?" "Not yet," she said. She wanted to hold on to that dream a little longer, I think. Guess what? Learning he was going to be a father didn't magically make Kenny, a kid himself, a better person. She raised that baby in her parents' house. I would say that was the attitude of half of my friends who got pregnant. They thought it would help them keep a man. The other half was like, "Oh, shit, I'm fucking pregnant." That's the half that Suge and I paid attention to as our friends kept popping those babies out. They were stuck then. We'd say no ma'am to that. I've got to have some money and have some fun. Ain't no way to do either sitting here having a bunch of babies. Suge told me not to mess with boys, if only for fear of the wrath of Evelina Fox, who would tell it to you straight. You're not bringing up a bunch of kids in your mama's house. You have to find someplace else to raise that baby. What I admired about Suge is that it could have been something she handled. She had been looking after kids since she was little. Why not stay comfortable with what you know? Having a baby grounded a lot of my friends where they were, and it was a reason not to have to pursue their dreams. Sundays were all about church, and our pastor, Reverend Arthur McClendon, delivered the word. He was a gentle soul, and always positive, never delivering fire from the pulpit unless he felt it was absolutely necessary. Obviously, Reverend McClendon knew my dad wasn't around, and he quietly became a second father to us Fox kids. He knew how we were doing at school and would urge us to stay focused on our studies. He had a wonderful sense of humor and smile. I spent so much time with him and his family, I didn't miss a day of vacation Bible school during school breaks. And you know, I sang in the damn choir. That's right. Volleyball practice, track, basketball, and there's Angie Fox running over to Breeding Tabernacle for choir practice. Me and my girls, Natalie, Sharon, and Georgia, we got all the solos. My favorite to sing then, and a hymn that transports me still, is Wade in the Water. Sing it with me for a second. Wade in the water, wade in the water, children, wade in the water. God's gonna trouble the water. It was not lost on us that this was a song important to the African-American community. It said the hymn was created as a coded message to assist the Underground Railroad, urging fugitive slaves to cross rivers so that the hellhounds of slave trackers lost their trail. An angel had troubled the water, waved its hand at it, and whoever entered that water would be free of sin. I thought about that beautiful song and all the hours I spent at Breeding Tabernacle recently while I was on the campaign trail for Hillary Clinton. I campaigned for Barack Obama, so they knew I was a worker bee. In 2012, my friend B.J. Coleman and I knocked on doors for him and went around to all the union halls. I passed out coffees to people waiting in line to get into rallies. It was fun and so rewarding to feel like I was part of something so much greater than just me. Every time President Obama sees me, he is so kind. He says in that excited voice, "Hey, Vivica." And everyone looks at me like, "What?" My heart leaps with pride, I assure you. He's just so cool, and his family is a shining example of American excellence. So when Hillary asked Angela Bassett and me if we would go help around South Carolina to get out the vote, I said, "Of course, Madam Secretary." I thought, it's only a few days. Besides, I believe in her vision. Well, by the second day, I was so tired. Like, God, I can't believe I signed up to do this kind of tired. That afternoon, after morning shows, radio interviews, and meet and greets, we visited some historically black colleges and universities to talk to young people. I ended up on a panel with some older gentlemen who had marched for civil rights all those years ago. As they shared stories about being beaten and sprayed and attacked by dogs, I just started crying. One guy talked about walking 3 miles to school, and his parents got up and walked with him so that he wouldn't get murdered by some asshole just because of the color of his skin. And the whole time, they let him know to be grateful that he was going to school. As they were talking, I looked out on all of these beautiful young faces of Generation Next in the audience, and I thought to myself, thank you, God, that I got up today and got out of my own way. I am so blessed to be here right now, and I have to give back. Then I thought, as I go up to speak, now go tell them. You guys are all our future leaders, I said to the audience. Our future first ladies, our future presidents, our future lawyers, our future mothers, our future preachers. You guys got next. And it's so important for me to let you all know that you matter, that you count. You matter too. You count too. I'm taking you to church here, I know. For me, focusing on my relationship with my Lord Jesus Christ has strengthened my resolve to be my best self. I want to experience all the blessings that he has for me. The lesson is not that you need to become Christian to get ahead. That turns my faith into some sort of get-rich-quick scheme. I'm just saying, you at least have to believe in yourself. Look at the blessings you have. Accept them with gratitude, and in return, work to use those gifts. If I'm really preaching anything with this book, it's that positivity works. Surround yourself with good people who want you to succeed. And once you do, give back and help the next generation along. I have seen so many people live and fail with this foolish notion that strengthening others somehow weakens them. They live closed off in a fearful, I got mine mentality. If you have negative friends and negative habits, how can you expect positive results? My friends from high school and church form my indie squad, and I still draw on the love and support that I found as a little girl. But nobody I knew had quite the same dream as me. There was no one to team with on reaching my goal of being a star. And then Pam Grier walked into my life with her gorgeous self. Well, not really. Some local affiliate played Foxy Brown, the classic 1974 film, in which Pam poses as a prostitute to take down a modeling agency that's really selling women into sex slavery. I was transfixed. As Foxy, Pam was sexy and beautiful and tough. She could kick your ass in that red cutout jumpsuit. None of us Fox kids were into TV. We'd rather be outside or at a game. But I leaned in watching Foxy Brown, marveling at this vision of what was possible. I began to model my demeanor on the blend of strength, smarts, and beauty of this unapologetically powerful black woman. The first I ever saw on television, she became my shero. Years and years later, I got a chance to interview Pam for a BET special. I could barely make it through the interview. I was crying so damn much. She had been my imaginary friend for so long, my squad goal. I even named my production company Foxy Brown Productions in tribute to her. I just, thank you, I said. Thank you for being such a role model to me all my life. I would not be who I am without you. Baby, that's what I'm here for, she said so graciously, taking my hand to make sure I understood that she meant it. To pass the torch to you, to inspire you so you know you can do it. With Pam as my life goal, I had begun to build my own squad, even if they were imaginary friends. I added Diana Ross and Michael Jackson to my little group of fantasy mentors when I got to see them in concert when I was a junior in high school. If Pam showed me the presence and grit of a movie star, that night, Diana showed me that a black woman could literally be the most glamorous person in the whole world. Miss Ross changed clothes 6 times, each gown more extravagant than the next, and I had never seen a black woman with hair and nails like that. She sang, "It's my house and I live here," reeling off all the little luxuries she had put in her home. She was rich, not because of some man, but because she had earned every dime. She was simply the most beautiful woman in the world I had ever seen. That really stayed with me. And then there was Michael, who showed me the power of entertainment. He came out to dance with her during Upside Down. He was magic. That's the only word to describe it. They delighted in each other on stage, holding the entire audience in their grip. And to a little black girl like me, the message was clear. Look how talented and cool we all are. You are part of this. You are special. Michael and Diana showed me models of what was possible. I'd put Diana Ross songs on and do little runway shows in my house, feeling she would approve of every supermodel turn of my face or hip. I used Michael's music as an exercise. I decided my calves were a little too bitty for a would-be athlete model like myself. So I'd jump rope to off the wall, both sides of the record, with little weights on my ankles to build up and tone my calves. And I dreamed that Michael would be so impressed with my dedication. This is a flash forward, but I will tell you that one of my very first gigs was as an extra on Michael's Remember the Time. You didn't see me? You sure? Okay. Well, my arm made a stunning cameo when Iman pushes away a servant's offer of tea. Yup, that's my arm. That's it. That's me. I screamed to my friends when the video appeared on MTV. That arm, right there. It didn't matter that I was an extra. I didn't care. I got to sit there all day and watch Michael Jackson dance. Wow, he was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen in my life. What I remember most is how he could pick up that choreography, because he was very quiet. He'd barely nod as they went over.